Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Kirk Gray.
Hey, Kirk. You know, in the last episode, I cut you off because you were going on about some New York Times article, and I thought, wait a second, that's a whole new topic. We got to come back to that one. But this was something to do with the kind of a story about that condo collapse in Florida.
Yeah, a Surfside condo was flawed and failing. Here's a look inside. It's an article by the New York Times that I thought was done very well as far as a failure analysis, post-failure analysis of the unfortunate collapse of the condo in Florida. And, you know, it showed how faulty design and construction might have been part of the reason the building collapsed. And the great thing is they go through it with animations that show sections of the building, the different materials, core samples of the concrete, and discussions of the steel reinforcing in the concrete and possible failure mechanisms that would lead to weakening of the columns and possible, you know, even the vibration of a building being constructed next door, and some of the heavy sand trucks might have come through, causing, you know, ground vibrations in that material that would transmit to the building. So there's a lot of information here. I thought it was an excellently done job, and then there's some really good comments from structural engineers about potential issues. But I think it follows a lot of just the way electronic manufacturing or any kind of system manufacturing or any kind of manufacturing of a product, that during the, you know, you have the initial design, which is ideal on paper, but then manufacturing and doing the manufacturing or building of it, you may have to make compromises.
Yeah, then the reality hits. That's what I always say.
Or your procurement department finds a cheaper alternative, which they think is equivalent, you know. Right. So, you know, whether there was greed, and, you know, they show some places where the rebar, a reinforcement metal in the concrete, there was supposed to be three rebars and there's only two. Well, of course, you know, maybe somebody thought we could save some money or
time or whatever. Yeah.
That we're not going to put three in there. We're going to put two. And, you know, that contributes. It makes it a little weaker with other factors like the being near salt water. And they said some water could have creeped up from the pilings underground.
Yeah.
And of course, we all know salt water is the worst.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that caught me, I mean, one is the whole story and the failure analysis. You know, it's unfortunate it wasn't well recognized, and actually the failure analysis work done prior to the collapse. I mean, why wait for a great disaster to now go pull out all the good strings? But they had symptoms, from what I remember from some of that reporting. There was cracks, and there was water in places there shouldn't
right.
be, and there was
right.
there were
right.
design changes that weren't really thought through, and changing the loads and structural design elements. And now, part of this issue, and it's not related or isolated just to building construction. We get it with bridges, we get it with all kinds of stuff. And you're exactly right, with electronics. You know, we've been putting solder on boards for years and years and years, so that we don't
right.
really even pay attention to it. Yet it is a significant source of problems with electronics, is cold solder joints or cracked leads or all kinds of stuff like that, just contamination and so on.
Right. And then we change solders too. That added to another.
Oh, that's another whole dimension of it.
Element
yeah.
in the mix. Yeah.
yeah.
Going from lead to.
Well, what I liked about that change was that it brought a lot more attention back to paying attention to what is a good solder joint. And so we were doing cross sections and look at inner metallics and is it really bonding and what's the right temperature. We did a ton of experiments to figure it out and make sure we had a robust system, because the leaded solder we'd been using for 50 years, it was so well characterized that you just put it down and it had a big window for it to actually work. And it was easy to visually check. It was bright and shiny. You know, the new stuff was not supposed to be bright and shiny because that meant it was bad. And so we had to retrain the entire workforce. But the idea is that one of the books I've read years ago was by Henry Petrosky, and it was called Design Paradigms. And it talked about different traps design teams get into that lead to just fundamental failures of their system. And he was studying railroad bridges, using those as examples because they're well documented and stuff like that. But the idea of buildings and building a condo, I bet you that building was not done by the eminent first architect that used concrete pilings with rebar. It was not done by that person.
No.
You know, that was done 100 years prior, right?
Right.
But that first person that did that, I bet you, I don't have the data on it, but I bet you they didn't skimp on rebar. They said, you know, we're going to make this instead of a 6x8 column, we're going to make it a 12x12 column. We're going to put 15 bars of, rebar in it. And tie it all together and do all this stuff.
Right.
It's going to be way over designed because there was a reputation on the line. This was a new model and it might create a whole nother industry. I'll be the architect that designed this and blah, blah, blah. And it's their own reputation. If it fails, they're out of business kind of thing. And they're already taking a risk. So they over design it. And then what happens is that that person then teaches the next generation, basically, how to do this, right? And they thin it out a little bit. They use a little less rebar. They make it lighter. They extend it for heavier loads and all this stuff. But there was so much margin in it that there's no issue. Now, the third generation learns this in school, right? Concrete and rebar is old hat. You just, anybody can do it. It's no big deal. And then they go one load too high or one rebar too few or whatever. The designs, it lose sight of there is a margin here. And what is the appropriate one? It's different when you design it from scratch and have no table to look it up and you got to go to experiment and try it. And then you double it just to be sure to, it's in a table. And concretes, they're all the same and it's not a big deal. And these guys know what they're doing. I don't have to look at it. And it just deteriorates over time. And so part of the issue is that we've put up way too many of these buildings and not paid attention to where's the margin and not reinforce that. So the other piece of your comment about this article was the animation of it. And I think, wouldn't that be cool if there was like the animation of how does a bolt shear, right? What you can see it in the bolt itself, you know, where the shear pattern is or the ductile failure or whatever kind of failures you have.
Right.
But to watch it happen and see animation of here's the forces, here's the loading, here's where it happened. You know, this is what this is the design elements that lead to that and so on.
Right.
That would be way cool to have that for all kind, like a cracked via. How does that manifest into a failure? You know, what's the step-by-step process of that to see that?
Right.
Oh, that would be so cool. Do you know any good animators? Animators? We got to find somebody.
Somebody got to be has to be motivated to develop this kind of, you know, I mean, it would take a lot of money. And, you know, fortunately, it's nice that New York Times has probably 25 people that did this wonderful three-dimensional animation showing the different support bars, support beams, and even the animations. So, yeah, to show how a via cracked or how a package becomes delaminated over time from a flaw in the package would be excellent. I mean, if we could see, you know, I guess we sort of got that with the Challenger explosion, with the O-ring. I mean, we know now in detail what the mistake was there that caused that. And it really was a matter of the engineers having, in fact, the ones closest, as we talked about in the previous, the ones closest to the question, the engineers at the design level said, don't fly in this temperature. Mm-hmm. We've never tested it and we don't have confidence. And engineering managers overruling that, unfortunately, leading to that disaster. But so there's some rare instances like this where very public failures and tragically cost lives that we get to see that kind of detail. And we've talked about in previous podcasts that that's so rare that we get to see the details of the failure analysis and what caused it and how we can link that back to, the issues, the pressures of construction changes and sometimes just trying to make something cheaper. As we happens all the time in our electronic manufacturing. The design was solid. Some of the engineers, after producing 1,000 or a million of those, said, "Hey, we over-designed it. Yeah, it's good." And then there's a pressure on procurement to always keep lowering the price and finding less expensive components, which sometimes is okay. I mean, sometimes it doesn't affect the design always. Yeah. It's not always that bad, but many times there was a reason that the manufacturer is cheaper because he doesn't do as many checks or tests or other things. And also he's, just copying a design he's not really familiar with and doesn't make it quite the exact same.
Yeah. But that's one of those things that it's like that design paradigm. This is a hard one to animate, but I think it could be done and you've seen resistors. They come in precision resistors or capacitors, like they're plus or minus 1%, and then there's 10% ones and so on.
That's right.
Right. But part of that is acknowledging that the process of making these things has variability. There's variation in that. But when in electronics, if I put a 100-ohm resistor there, my circuit is probably going to work fine if that's really a 90-ohm resistor or 110-ohm resistor. I'm going to still get the basic effect that I need. And it might even work at 80 and 120.
Right.
But at some point, it's going to lose its capability to function. And one of the things that's hard for, and I know capacitors do this in particular, depending on the technology of the resistors, not so much, is they drift. I have 100 picofarad capacitor, it's not always going to be that. It will change over time. And it drifts. Yeah. It drifts.
Right.
And so a good designer takes that into account, saying, well, this should last for 10 years. And so I'm going to design it such that it'll start at the high end of that range where I need it to work in the design, and it'll drift down through the best place, and then it'll work longer because it's still within that sweet spot.
Right.
And they do due diligence on doing that, but they need to understand these capacitors drift. This technology has these kinds of phenomena. And we used to teach classes at HP like that, talking about electrolytic capacitors and a variety of other technologies that we would go through in detail. We even had a video. Well,
that's something that fundamentally the design engineer should know of.
They should know it, but they don't get.
They should know.
They don't get taught that in school. You didn't learn that in school. You learn it on the job, or or unless you're going to school for failure analysis.
But in electrical engineering school, I do remember one professor. We were just talking about the beta of transistors. Mm-hmm. I mean, back in my ancient times in the 70s when discrete transistors were used.
Yeah.
He says, you don't know what kind of, your beta could be from, your factor could be from 4 to 100. He says, so you have to design the circuit with this tolerance in mind, using, only a small possible, making it less sensitive to that variable, the beta variable.
Right.
And so That's kind of what you're talking about with the drift of the capacitor, you know, that they got to know this window, this wide window that it's going to drift in.
Right.
It's not going to affect the sensitivity of the circuit, you know.
Well, we had one video we used to show, and you know of, was it electromigration? You know what that failure mechanism is? We had a video on
The movement of, movement of actual
atoms
metal
of copper, it was copper or silver or whatever it is, whatever the metal is, the trace is. If you have too much
moves,
current, if you have too much current,
moves
the current going through a line, it finds a little spot that it's a little bit constrained. You know, it might be just a very small defect in the material or in the way the trace was cut or whatever, just a choke point.
Right.
And the current squeezes through that. And then it starts, it's like pushing water through a hose. It's going to speed up there. So that momentum of the current, which is electrons, right? They're not very big things. But if you do it, if you get too much current in too small a cross-sectional area, it will actually move the molecules of copper or the atoms of copper. It'll pile them up.
Right.
And it'll pile them up downstream. And we had a video showing that. They actually had a microscope and a camera on it and I don't know how long it took, showing this.
A time lapse of it, because it does take some time.
It does take some time, but they, you know, you could see the thinning out of one section and the building up just downstream from it. And it was, and when a designer would see that, they go, all right, I need to figure out the cross-sectional area of my traces and make sure I'm not putting too much current in there.
Right. And there's design rules for that.
Yeah.
There are design rules that you adhere to about the thickness and current carrying capabilities of a trace. And so, yeah, that should be, it's just like, you know, that's kind of one of the four standard mechanisms in semiconductors that are considered one of the four wear out modes, such as negative temperature bias instability and hot carrier injections and those kinds of things. So the design rules though, keep that those should be adhered to. Now, with those design rules, you know, you got to also realize the tolerance and variation in the manufacturing process that, you know, what it can do, what is capable of, the capability of that process in making those particular issues non-critical or not.
More robust. You need a design that's more robust.
Right,
But part of it is understanding it. You know, that's the part that I find, and you've commented on this many times, is that we get these big public accidents that get detailed failure analysis available to us. Why is this just not more? That's when I talk to a vendor for a component, says, how does it fail? And how do you know? What's the, you know, what is the mechanisms that are most likely to cause failure? And what's the story there? And they often don't want to talk about that. Oh, it'll just work. I says, no, it won't.
It will
fail. What's the way it's going to fail? If I go high temperature, is that going to be worse or low temperature?
Right.
I need to know the mechanism to do lots of decision making. And I think
if you don't, if you don't understand the mechanism, you can't improve it. You know, you can't address it. So
that's right.
That's real fundamental to all reliability. Without understanding unreliability, you can't can't move forward.
But that might be, you know, this is our call for a great graphic artist is to take a look at this article and let's write up a story for each failure mechanism. Going, this is, I mean, some of it is a combination of things, and that's what makes it difficult. There's some poor decisions. There's some material variability.
Right.
There's some unexpected loads, or there's this creep function that happens first, and then this corrosion occurs. Some failure mechanisms are really complex. And I think having a better understanding of them is a start to help us understand how to design out of those things and avoid them, or what to pay attention to before a failure occurs.
That's a dream of mine, Fred. It's like Backblaze, the cloud storage company that publishes the failures of each, the rates of failures of each drive, our manufacturer and model and everything.
Yep.
And if we could only get the detailed failure analysis from each company that has the high rates, you know, the highest rates. And here's why these were failing in the field. You know, this is why we had the 3% or 5% failure rate that what normally we'd expect, 0.3%, something like that. And, yeah, you know, that's what, and, just, it's frustrating because it'll never happen. We'll never see that. It won't ever occur. And it'll be up to engineers working serially from company to company to accumulate and that knowledge of the fact that most of these things are assignable causes to a series of events, either, you know, design or manufacturing or misuse of the product.
Misuse or maintenance. Well, have you seen the articles? I know Shane's been posting on LinkedIn, Shane Trucott. And I think he runs a failure analysis lab, and he's got a bunch of pictures of bolts and materials and different things.
Yeah,
and how do you read a fracture to piece together what was the story? How did it fail? And he does a bunch of other stuff like that. But he has, in one of the advantages of a good failure analysis lab, is they take some cool pictures and then they can piece together like a detective. Oh, great stories.
Yeah.
But I think that needs, and what he's doing is exactly what we're talking about. Here's some failures. You don't need to know where this came from, right? This was a bolt on a flange and it failed. It doesn't identify all the details of that, but it gives us, this is why this failed. This was a material defect. This was overstress. This was this. But those should get translated into awareness and design teams. This is why I have to pay attention to it.
I know. And there's just so many NDAs. I companies that don't exist anymore. I had some beautiful failure analysis photos and cross sections of different devices and things like that I should have taken with me. And because they don't exist, you know, the company doesn't exist. There's nobody there to complain about. And they were really details. I didn't really need to say what it, you know, necessarily was. But or who the manufacturer was, and I did some of that in my book, and you know, with just sanitizing and not identifying any particular model or manufacturer, but trying to step you through how the issue was found and resolved.
Well, that might be the call out today. Is, you know, if you've got a great failure analysis story, or you've got, you know, a great graphic artist that can create these stories, or that create the animations or details of how things fail, or you know a good trove of those things, I think it would be a really cool article series to post of, you know, here's electromigration, here's corrosion, here's this, here's that, and here's the details of it. But it does take good imagery and good details of the fundamentals of what's going on in a way that can be used to avoid it.
Right.
That's hard to do.
Be great if we could put some of those on Exendo Reliability, you know, some little video or graphics that, like you'll see in this, if anybody goes to the New York Times and looks at this excellent graphic article that they have, if we could do something like that, you know, on Exendo. You don't have any animations right now or videos, I don't think.
Yeah, there's videos. There's a handful of people that do vlogs, video blogs, but they're just talking heads mostly, or talking over slides.
They're not showing actual devices or mechanisms or things like that, right?
No, I've talked to Shane in the past about doing a series, but he hasn't committed to it yet, so I'm trying to get more of his stuff on it because it's great info.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that's the most useful, is those guys that show the actual mechanisms and show that it wasn't really, you know, something that, it shows this assignable cause, that they know what the reason was. And it was usually outside of, you know, normal manufacturing parameters or something like that. So, it's just, to me, again, trying to model these things is nearly impossible. Modeling reliability is, to me, nearly impossible, because there's so many factors that are involved in, and they're usually not typically carry from one design to the other. And in fact, they're very complex and typically unique to each system, not something that is regular and consistent and persistent in the industry. So other than lithium ion batteries wearing out, that's about it. And that's great for modeling. And Kaus has done a great job on some of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, there's stories out there. We need to just find them and find somebody willing to write them up and put them out there and stuff.
Go ahead,
would
be
way
brave.
Cool. Yeah.
Be brave.
So, yeah. Be brave. Let us know. You can get in touch with us at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. If you've got some cool failure mechanisms you'd like to talk about or have us talk about and explore some more, let us know. Or if you'd like to help put some package, you know, series of articles or videos together, that would be awesome. Let us know. And you can also get in touch with us at through LinkedIn. Kirk and I and the other hosts are all available there, or on our about pages on Ascendo. We have contact info and forms and stuff like that. But we do enjoy, really love hearing from you and ideas and suggestions you may have, and whatever's on your mind, let us know. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.